From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting live from Managua, Nicaragua.
A lot to cover this week. Let's get started.
Yeah, can we start with Chile? They had their presidential elections on Sunday. There, the results, and there are a couple of observations I want to make before we start talking about the actual results. One is that the more you look at the kind of political results that we're seeing in South America's southern cone, Chile and Argentina, obviously, but also Uruguay and Paraguay, the more you realize the deep effect, the deep long-term effect that the coup against Salvador Allende and the dictatorship in Argentina, both of which were strongly supported. In the first case, they were the coup against Salvador Allende was actually created and devised and put into action by the United States government, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, and all those people. All, you know, if, name a right-wing diplomat or foreign affairs person in the United States establishment through the 80s and 90s, and all of them cut their teeth on Chile.
That's right.
So, you know, people like Richard Armitage, John Negroponte, all those people.
The world of economics also, you know, you had the whole Chicago School group of people talking, you know, they, when Kissinger said, let's make the economy scream, these are the people that helped engineer that, to design it.
Right.
Yep.
So, and then you had people like Vernon Walters and Gene Kirkpatrick making apologies or not even apologies, but justifying the dictatorship in Argentina.
Yeah.
And the overall effects on Chile and Argentina of that long period of repression and mass murder, because that's what the United States government was supporting. It was supporting mass murder of civilian opposition to their right-wing cronies governments.
Pretty much liquidation of the left, really. I mean, that was the goal in it. And what you're describing, in essence, in the process of describing, is the aftermath of, you know, it's the outline of the body on the ground, basically.
Right. And so, and we're seeing the long-term effect of that here in that Argentina and Chile are just coming out of that. The new generation since the 70s and 80s are just beginning to emerge into an effective left-wing political movement. In Argentina, it's still you still see how the political left is kind of hobbled by for all kinds of reasons. But if they united, they'd have a natural majority over the right wing.
Right.
And the same is now true in Chile. And this election marks that. You can say that this last election on Sunday marked that. The other thing before we go on to the results is the role of the polling companies.
Yeah.
Now, the polling companies were hopelessly wrong in Venezuela. They did a better job in Argentina, but they were also hopelessly in Argentina's recent legislative elections, but they were also hopelessly wrong here in Chile.
Yep.
Because as you and I noted the last time we spoke, the Frente Amplio barely registered in the opinion polls, and they actually came within 1.3% of being the party that sent their candidate into the December 17th runoff.
That's right. Yeah, they were very close. I mean, look, when you see this constantly happening, what you realize is these are not polls. These are push polls. These are, you know, PR weapons, not scientific gauging or measurement and reporting of sentiment.
Yeah, so let's look at the results then. And so the in Chile, what you got was Sebastián Piñera, the right-wing candidate who'd been predicted by the polling companies to be almost on the verge of winning on the first round, which would require 50% of the votes. And okay, the other thing about the Chilean elections was that characteristically the turnout is low, around between 40 and 45%. But this time it was 52%, so that's slightly better than previous elections. Right. Now, Piñera got 36% of the vote, which sounds like a good result for him, but it's not. It's a bad result for Piñera. He should have got over 40% right. on the first round if he's thinking of an easy win on the second round. So that easy win on the second round, he can forget about it.
Right.
The right wing, the other right wing candidate, a guy called Cast, got something like 7%. Now, it's by no means certain that all Cast supporters will vote for Piñera on the second round. But even if they do, that only takes them up to 43%, right. maybe a little more, maybe 44%, something like that. Now, if you look at the situation for the center-left and left, the emergence of Beatriz Sanchez as a very strong contender to get into the second round, she only lost by 1.3% behind Alejandro Guillier, who's the candidate of the Nueva Mayoría coalition that supports the policies of current President Michelle Bachelet. The fact that Beatriz Sanchez came so close to getting into the second ballot means that now Alejandro Guillier, if he's going to stand a snowball's chance in hell of winning the second round on December the 17th, he has to make concessions to the left wing in the Frente Amplio, right. because he got something like, what was it, 22%. Beatriz got
20.27%. Yeah.
And then there are there's the Christian Democrat candidate,
right?
Who historically have been quite resistant to the left.
Catalina, she got 5.88%.
Yeah, and the recent historic leader Ricardo Lagos of the Christian Democrats has publicly said that he thinks that the Christian Democrats should vote unconditionally for Guillier.
Okay.
So that immediately gives Guillier 5%. That takes him up to sort of 27-28%.
Then you got the progressive candidate also got almost 6%, 5.71%.
Exactly. So that takes them over 30%.
Right.
Then with Beatriz Sanchez.
Right. Now you're over 50.
So they, unless they screw up, Alejandro Guillier should win the second ballot. But not in the sense people have been saying, oh, it's just more of it'll just be more of the same. Well, it won't.
Right.
Because if Guillier has to negotiate with Sanchez,
right.
then you're looking at a much more progressive agenda, both domestically and almost certainly in international terms.
Right.
Now, that is something that none of the commentators that I've seen have mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about if you're going to put together a 52% or whatever it ends up being, well, that would be a majority over 50%. Then 20, you know, like say 40% of that, in other words, 20% of the 50% rests on the left. The left has considerable influence, and it's not even at the margins at that point. This is part of the base.
Not just in the sense of the negotiations around the composition of the of support for Guillier in the second round on December 17th.
Right.
The Frente Amplio got something like, and I think they've got 20 seats in the National Congress, which is a tremendous breakthrough. They've never had that many seats.
Yeah.
In Congress. That means that they're going to be power brokers in Congress because Piñera doesn't have a majority. He's something like 10 or 12 seats short of having a majority in the National Congress. And Cast, the right-wing Cast, his deputies in Congress won't make good that deficit.
Right.
So that means that the center-left and left parties should be able to block, even if Piñera wins, which I don't think he will. He might. We just never know. But on balance, as things look now, Piñera should lose on the runoff on the 17th, and there should be if the center left and left wing parties can keep it together, there should be a natural majority for their government in Congress. which will make a huge difference to things like education reform, pension reform.
Lots of. I mean, you got 150 seats in the Chamber of Deputies, okay? So the broad front pulls down 20 of those seats, okay? But the force of the majority, which is the Social Democrats, Radicals, the Communists, the Socialists, and the Party for Democracy, they pulled down 43 seats. So between the two, you've got 63 seats out of 150, just those two. And then you've got a number of others that are in play where you can assemble,
Christian Democrats, the other progressives,
104 seats for them,
Well, maybe I'm being too optimistic.
No, not really. I mean, I'm looking at the numbers, and this seems like you got the Progressive Party has 108, whatever that is. But the Citizen Left is 7, out of the Democratic Convergence with the CDP. Reaching 75 seats, 76 votes seems definitely possible looking at this. Particularly, not every vote is an ideological yes or no either. There are lots of things where you can make progress in coalition.
Yeah, so it may not be a watershed election in a dramatic sense, but it does definitely mark a strong change in Chilean politics,
right.
And that's a tremendously positive sign, especially in terms of foreign policy, because if Guillermo gets elected, and if Beatriz Sánchez exercises the kind of influence that one might expect her to exercise, Chile's position vis-a-vis Venezuela should change radically.
Yeah.
And that is, in regional terms, that is absolutely key.
Yep.
Because just as back in the 70s, Nixon and Vernon Walters and Kissinger and all those people understood very clearly from a class point of view that they had to crush Salvador Allende's government in order to defend the interests of the Western corporate elites in Latin America. The same thing is happening now against Venezuela.
Yep.
Right.
Absolutely true. It's even a bigger game, really. I mean, Chile, for all the the exploitation that the U.S. did of copper mines, and that because they had a modern economy, AT&T and these other corporations, that were sucking money out of there too. Nothing like, gee, this is one of the largest oil reserves in the world. Venezuela, just in terms of it's as a player. As an oil power, quote unquote, has something that Chile didn't have. And in addition to that, the role that Venezuela has played in the entire sort of slow moving nullification of the Monroe Doctrine and the assemblage of South America, Caribbean, Central America union, economic entity, et cetera. Venezuela is at the heart of that. So they are, more of what Chile was back in 1973 or whatever it was, now.
Oh yeah, and I agree with that, Don. Yeah. So then let's move on if we can to Honduras. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's start. And the first thing to say about Honduras is, again, with the polls that are actually public relations weapons and not measures of political sentiment.
Yeah. Now, that's dead right, and so the main candidates in Honduras are the old style Liberal Party, who's a guy called Luis Zelaya Medrano, I think his second surname is, not to be confused with Mel Zelaya.
Not at all.
he's the Liberal Party is just about keeping going as a significant political player in Honduras. They've been very heavily overshadowed by the National Party, the ruling National Party under Juan Orlando Hernandez. He's standing for re-election. Well, let's talk about that in a minute. Okay. And the other main candidate is Salvador Nasralla of I've forgotten what the party's called, Alliance Against the Dictatorship, I think it's called, that is the party of his anti-corruption party that did very, very well in the 2013 election, and the Libre Party that almost beat the National Party in that 2013 election. So the combination of Nasralla and Mel Zelaya and his wife, the Xiomara Castro's leadership of the Libre Party, they in their alliance should win, because back in 2013, Libre got something like 31%. And they were just behind the National Party, which won the election by a very narrow margin on something like 33%, I think they won the election by. And Salvador Nasralla had something like 20%.
Right.
Now, obviously, you can't transpose those figures from 2013 to 2017 because right. so much has changed.
Yeah.
But that it won't be very different. They should still get between them get between 45 and 50%. And the National Party will not get that. I'll be flabbergasted if the National Party get more than 40%.
Right.
And what that means is that and the Liberal Party will probably, the Zelaya will probably get around 10, 12%, something like that. And I doubt very much that Luis Zelaya will get more than 20%.
Right.
If he does, that changes things a lot, because he will take support from the Alliance Against the Dictatorship Coalition. But I don't think he will. I think that that coalition, the Nasralla, Zelaya, Mel Zelaya coalition, should get between 45 and 50%. I don't think the National Party will get more than 40%, and I think that Luis Zelaya will get between. He might get as much as 15%, but even if he gets 15%, that should mean that Nasralla wins. Now, unless I'm mistaken, there's no second round in Honduras.
No, there's not.
Whoever right. gets the most votes wins.
Right. And, you know, so, in 2013, there was a huge vector also in terms of the polling and the actual results. The Hernandez was understated back then, which is an interesting phenomenon. They were showing him at like between 22 and 28% roughly, and he ended up pulling down 36.89. Castro at the time was shown at between 22.8 was the low one, up to 31.2, and Castro only ended up coming in at 28.78. So you had Nasralla was understated, 9% to 11% roughly, and actually came in at 13.43. So, you know, this is closer in time to the coup, though. So they didn't really need to be so aggressive with those techniques, because they, you know, in the aftermath of a coup, you know, the bad guys
Those must be the final results, Don. Because I'm puzzled that I misremembered them so badly, but I remember the results I gave were the results from election night, because I remember it so vividly.
Oh.
So yeah, those must be the final results after all the final count was.
Well, it's been 4 years, so yeah.
And so yeah, but I'm staying with that issue that you just mentioned of the effects of the coup. I'm Juan Orlando Hernandez got the legislature that his party controls to ratify his re-election, which is precisely what the coup is about. So there's tremendous hypocrisy here from the Honduran political establishment, because what they've done is they've said, essentially they're saying, we don't mind if there's an extreme right winger re-elected, but we're certainly not going to have we're not going to allow even the suggestion that a progressive candidate could be re-elected, because the coup back in 2009 was based on completely false propaganda, which
right.
was parroted in the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the Western corporate media, that Mel Zelaya was trying to push for re-election, which was completely false.
You know, and not only, like, I just have to say, I don't know where else you can hear this, but when someone starts discussing the New York Times parroting something, we actually have live parrots in the background to drive home the point.
All right, okay.
But go ahead, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They more or less retailed the same propaganda that was being pushed by the coup mongers, people right. responsible for the coup. Yes. When in fact Nelzelaya, what he was pushing for was a constituent assembly just to look at the constitution and see whether right. it should be changed.
Right.
But, you know, I remember that vividly because I was in Tegucigalpa on the day of the coup.
Right.
So then that scenario carried forward to now shows you how serious the risk is that, for example, the National Electoral Tribunal or the court should any results end up being going to a litigation,
yeah.
and everything is weighted against
yeah.
the Progressive Coalition.
Hernandez did this back in December 2012. He replaced four of the Supreme Court judges, and they ended up securing his nomination, which ended up in front of the court in 2013 as a candidate. And if he didn't replace four members of the Supreme Court, he wouldn't have even been on the ballot.
Yeah, but there was no outcry about that anywhere.
Not in the New York Times.
In
yeah.
the West.
Yeah,
no Western government complained about that. No Western corporate media headlined that. It just went completely under the radar. No,
right.
Move along, please. Nothing to see here. That's
exactly right. That's exactly right.
So that's the context for the elections in Honduras
this coming Sunday. Right. Yeah. Yep.
So that's if there's a more or less clean election, because Honduran elections are notorious for their corruption, and by both the traditional political parties that tend to control the election apparatus, but let's see how well the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, led by Salvador Nasralla as their candidate, do. And they should have learned from their experience in 2013. Let's hope they have.
Yeah, let's hope indeed. And I'm hoping that there's some institutional protection also. The last time, not just the levers of power domestically were secured, to put it kindly, by the right wing, but also the international observers who were there, and the Carter Center, for example, last time had said that they were concerned about the way some things appear to be shaping up. The people coming into the country to be election observers and journalists were harassed, and you had people from the UN, even from the OAS, from the EU, from the Carter Center. You know, there were reports from a variety of institutional, the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, even others said, hey, they're being harassed, illegally detained, interfered with, threatened, things like that, and unidentified armed men, doing harassment and intimidation.
Yeah, and the army, the Honduran army, has said that they're going to safeguard the elections, which is like a threat.
Yeah, right. Hey, so you're going to get some protection.
Sorry, Don. And just a footnote there. And I've forgotten the name of the head of the guy who's leading up the Organization of American States delegation, but he's a right winger. Who is likely to validate the elections because that's his ideological bent. I don't think we can expect much by way of the OAS if in the event of some controversy. They're going to side with Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, even absent a controversy, just to the extent that Hernandez needs their help, they're there to do it.
Right. So, and should we move on to other stuff? There's Ecuador,
yeah, just
Colombia.
Before we do, I just want to make a very quick comment, by the way. I mean, what we're talking about here, of course, is not meddling in someone else's democratic election like the Russians did to the Americans.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. And that's important to emphasize.
Yeah. Just to mention it, at least, yep, for sure.
It's the United States engaging what it regards as its legitimate oversight of events in its backyard.
Yeah, right. Go ahead.
So, yeah.
Ecuador, so then, I guess, right? Yeah.
There are various other noteworthy events happening in countries like Ecuador, Colombia, and of course Venezuela. The big event in Venezuela was the conference or the meeting, I think it was on Monday, between Venezuela and its creditors. It's not clear what if any agreement resulted from that. Venezuela needs to refinance its debt because the U.S. sanctions, together with moves by European banks that are integral parts of the United States control of the international finance system, like Deutsche Bank, for example, the big German bank, the international banking system is following. Is obeying U.S. sanctions and preventing Venezuela from meeting its financial obligations.
Right.
So although Venezuela sends the money out to meet its financial obligations on time, the financial system, the international financial system, and its member banks slow that down, resulting in a situation where Venezuela falls behind in terms of the schedule of payments, not in terms of whether it's actually able to make the payments. It's making the payments, but there are fixed dates on which the payments have to be made, and there's a fixed period of grace if the payment isn't made on that fixed date. So and if the payments then fall outside that grace period, then it's possible for creditors, ill-intentioned creditors, to activate insurance mechanisms so that they can collect insurance alleging a technical default. Although the money is there, it's not that the money isn't there, it's just been delayed. It's not Venezuela's fault that the payment has been delayed. It's the U.S. sanctions deliberately creating that effect. And the result of one of the results of that that's very disturbing is, just as we saw in the case of Argentina back in 2015, when there was that long saga involving the rescheduling of the payment of Argentina's rescheduled debt in the context of harassment and intimidation from people like Paul Singer and his vulture fund and other vulture funds. Now we're seeing this again, because the technical default as a result of Venezuela's payments being delayed by the international banking system has triggered a decision by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, which is an organization of financial gangsters which makes rulings on their relationships with their victims. And that's what the International Swaps and Derivatives Association essentially is.
Yes, that's right.
They've made a decision favoring their members so that their members can collect insurance because of Venezuela's technical default.
Right.
Now, it remains to be seen what is going to be the result of that.
Yeah, you've seen both Russia restructuring a billion and change of debt with Venezuela over the past week, and China in the background, in essence, sending sort of a tacit message that hey, our steady hand is here, don't worry. And so I don't know what impact that has on the real markets, not just the response to the rating agencies, the self dealers like the ones you're describing, but the actual markets. And we're going to have to see how that plays out. And that's all we have time for today. It's too bad, but we'll get to more of it next week because there's a lot. And we can talk about Colombia.
I look forward to talking to you.
Yeah, the same. And we'll get into Colombia next week and some other things. And I guess we'll be talking about the election in Honduras. Tony, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Okay. Thanks a million, John.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.